Welcome to Immaterial Voices, a podcast about photography, publishing, and bookmaking. Immaterial Voices is part of the Immaterial Books Publishing House based in Champaign, Illinois. This is episode 1 of Immaterial Voices. I am your host, Brian O'Neill. In this episode, recorded back in March of 2024, I speak with photographer, sociologist, and ethnographer Julie Patron-Josek. In 2024, Julie released a new monograph titled The Thread of Water, Ethnography, Photography, and Feminist Ecologies, which marked the occasion for this discussion. Joining us on the panel to talk about the book was President of the International Visual Sociology Association, Greg Scott, as well as Jessica Hayes, visiting lecturer at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga, and photographer Micah McCoy. In this discussion, we talk about the connection between ethnography and photography as documentary practices, the scope of the book itself, including its foundational themes and concerns about feminist scholarship, as well as a bit about the process of bringing together an image and text work. I hope you enjoy the episode. Over the past 10 years, many social scientists have emphasized the heuristics of the marine environment when seeking to understand, for instance, how oceans have been historically linked to human societies through the generation of ecological crises, but also how colonial and capitalist politics of seas and oceans persist today, how environmental history benefits from indigenous knowledge of the sea, how the land-sea separation has shaped Western modernity, and how underwater cables materialize histories of land-sea geographies and politics. Diving activities, as such, have been investigated by anthropologists for how they unveil social dynamics of otherness, bodily techniques, and affects. However, rare are ethnographic studies, where the researcher descends into the ocean, immersing themselves for the sake of fieldwork. And I thought that set up this project and what we're going to talk about nicely, because even more rare, I think, are visual ethnographic accounts of these kinds of dynamics. And so, you know, one of the things that drew me to this project, and the reason I think that Julie and I started to move forward with Immaterial Books was that it was not only just about photography or just about, you know, the visual world, but it included, you know, some of these elements of social theory, dynamics of politics, the economy, colonialism, as she mentioned here. There's multiple different issues and dynamics at play that can be brought out and, in a sense, unsubmerged through the book form, really. And so that's something that we're interested in general, with what we're trying to do with Immaterial Books. With that, let's move over to Julie, and I'll let you talk about the book. Enough of me talking. Julie, take it away and get the panel going for us.
Yeah. So what I'm going to do is start by reading part of chapter 4, because I think it's a good introduction of many ideas I wanted to develop in this book, which is, as you mentioned, not only about photography. Because the book itself includes many different formats or forms of narratives, which was the point of the project, like using photography and drawings and ethnographic film art, poetry, and to have tried to build this multi-layered narrative in what I hope is more sensorial cape than a photography book, because it really aims at like echoing experiences through different ways to build a narrative. So there are, as you know, but as other people might not know yet, there are a few chapters in this book 5. plastic lives, flowing bodies, mythologies, colonial scapes, resilience. And this structure in five chapters was for me a way to articulate questions or ideas I had when I started to work on this book, which was a few months after leaving Russia because I was a lecturer then at the State University of St. Petersburg. And I was at the time asking myself a lot of questions about my future as a scholar or as a university lecturer, and also questions about research ethics in ethnography. And I started diving. I didn't have a specific rationale for that. I just wanted to try diving because there was the sea. I mean, I was living literally on the beach close to the Mediterranean Sea. So I was like, why not? And this is how it started. It's actually how the book opens as well. So the book evolves to chapter four, about more centered about colonial politics of underwater resources. And it uses again different forms of narratives that have been beautifully layered by immaterial books. So thank you for that. And it has the specificity of using thermal imagery, which doesn't work underwater, but that was the point of using thermal imagery techniques for this book. And maybe this is something we can further discuss later on. The colonial scape. One little thing before I start reading again is that how the book is structured around a theory called hydrofeminism, which was developed by different philosophers and especially Astrid Annemannes, who is currently at the University of Vancouver in Canada. And a few years ago, as part of like her post-human feminism framework, she started to develop this very organic theory of embodiment related to water that she calls hydrofeminism. And this is like a fil rouge, or the main line in the narrative of this book. The lessons provided by hydrofeminism and ecofeminism in general are connected to those provided by holistic cosmologies, against which Western rationality was developed. According to holistic systems of belief, human beings are not separated nor independent from the natural and cosmic environment in which they live. Their destiny is connected to the stars. Their daily life is rhythmed by the elements and their celebration. Their family circle includes celestial bodies and other entities inhabited by spirits in the natural world. For Zuni Native Americans, the moon is not only a living body, but also a sacred entity due respect and ritual performance. According to this cosmology, sending a rocket and landing on the moon to drill its ground and take samples back to the earth is a dangerous, inconsiderate act likely to bring disorder in the global harmony of the cosmos, of which human beings are an active part. Similarly, indigenous ecologies present water as a sacred body carrying life, time, memories, dreams, premonitions, all those being signs of divine communication with the mortals, either in the form of rivers, deltas, estuaries, puddles, waves, wetlands, reservoirs, oceans, or rain. Water bears consciousness and the promises of cosmic connection. The apprehension of the underwater world that many divers have as a hostile environment that human bodies need to master and tackle to survive was steered by this cosmology, opposing the suspicion of the world as a machine of perpetual motion and its appreciation as a coherent living organism. The indices have been shaped through worldwide history by representations, fantasies, and colonial frameworks related to territoriality, otherness, and resource utilization as part of the very notion of exploration. A conception of exploration as a conquest over whiteness for the benefit of industrialization and as the expression of power by a human species unconscious of its connection to the soil. Subaquatic experiences, including how these experiences are put into words and images, are historically situated and deeply culturally grounded. Early underwater aesthetics reflect the vision of the underseas both as a hostile space and as a territory to explore. Creative methods can serve as a strong counter narrative to these aesthetics and help craft a cosmic language of the underseas tethered to its ecology. A language where visuals build a meditative and reflexive rendering in the depth of the Mediterranean Sea and a nod to oddness. A language where imagery investigates the eeriness of Sumerian weightlessness and bodies' resilience in undefined landscapes. A language subverting underwater imagery techniques and their visual effects. A language acting as an alternative to the exploitation of subaquatic wilderness and of the celebration of its enlightening shadows. And I'm going to stop the reading here.
Yeah, I think that's perfect, and that's there's so many different themes there that Julie and I, as we were working on the early stages of this book, and we were talking about it, so many of those elements that she was talking about in that passage that really spoke to me as a photographer, and especially as a sociologist. I mean, just even that distinction there that I think you were making, Julie, about exploration and interest in exploration, but what kind of exploration? Exploration without conquest, things like that. Jess, go ahead and take it away.
Yeah. I found chapter two of, I mean, I was really engaged with the whole book. I was really excited when it came in the mail and I got to spend some time with it, and I've read through it more than once already. but I really found chapter two, which is called Flowing Bodies, especially engaging, probably or maybe because of my own interest in like humanity's connection and entanglement with their surroundings. And I really resonated with this idea of seeing ourselves as bodies of water, these kind of like enclosed bodies of water rather than like being sort of severed from our surroundings. And I think that really requires us to contend with how our actions affect our surrounding environment. If we are like water, then we are no different than a river or a pond or an irrigation ditch running through our front yard. And I was wondering, Julie, if you might be able to talk more about the role that you think hydrofeminism could play in sort of erasing that false barrier that we've created between humans and their surroundings. That's what I was really focused on. I've reread that chapter like three times. So
that's perfect. That's perfect. Well, we appreciate it. And I have some questions about that as well. So we're going to come back to this topic here in short order. Yeah. So Greg, go ahead. If you have some opening statements.
My opening statement is that the book reorganized my consciousness in a really fundamental way. Like when I first got into it and began to appreciate what it is and also what it's not, it really affected me in a profound way, in a way that most work doesn't. And I live by the lake, by Lake Michigan in Chicago. And all things aquatic and marine are a huge part of my life and the way I see the world and the way that my community is organized here as well. And reading Julie's work shaped and reshaped my sort of daily existence. Like I read it, I immersed myself in it. And that immersion in the book reorganized my immersion in daily life. And I found myself constantly reflecting on hydrofeminism, on sort of, critical ecology, and on photography and imagery more generally. And it was a really exciting time. And it's one of the reasons it took me so long to actually produce a final draft of the afterword essay. I think I went through 9 different drafts of the thing, trying to get it right, but also giving up to the very real reality of never getting anything quite right. And so that was like a really good moment. It hit me in a really important time and a really important juncture in my career, because I've spent so much of my career over 2.5 decades engaged in visual sociological work, largely representational, largely documentary oriented, documentary photography, documentary filmmaking, and also as a kind of person in the field of visual sociology who has and to some extent, my generation and I have received a baton that has been passed to us by the elders in the visual sociology community who started this subfield in the 80s. And I have inherited, quite uncritically, a real passion for continuing the work of legitimizing this discipline. And legitimizing this discipline means a lot of things. In part, it means creating and sustaining and perpetuating an index of ways of seeing, of ways of accounting, of ways of explaining, ways of investigating the social world using image-producing technologies. And in doing so, I've participated in the act of stifling and submerging of other ways of knowing. And it really occurred to me as I was experiencing this book as odd, weird, liminal, oblique, that it is truly visual sociology. And it is doing something that no one else has done in visual sociology for fear of delegitimization or fear of like being outside the canon, outside the index. And I think that it's that experimentation that Julie's engaged in here that is most exciting to me, that pushing of these boundaries, the subversion and the undermining of conventional ways of knowing and thinking and seeing and explaining and conceptualizing. That to me is so very exciting. And also, the final thing I'll say is that on a very personal level, I've struggled for probably like 20 years to explain myself to myself or other people with regard to the work that I do. And by that, I mean, I have this whole, like, the way I've always explained it is I have these two tracks. I'm like doing documentary photography and filmmaking. It's, you know, very like traditional sort of empirical reality, you know, reality-based, reality constructing work. And then there's this other side of my life that's experimental. And I spend actually most of my time engaged in experimental film and photography. And I've been explaining those things as separate tracks. And this book and engaging in this bold work, and through Julie's courageous exploration here, I've actually been able to see so much crossover, and I see that there's actually not a dividing line. There's a great deal of fuzziness and a great deal of ambiguity and a great deal of unknowing. And now I'm just able to be more comfortable in that. And so I've actually stopped explaining myself as having these two different paths and just have kind of stopped explaining myself. And now I just experience it. And that's super exciting for me, just on a personal, professional, and professional level. So that's where I'll stop.
Thanks so much, Greg. Yeah, you speak to, I think, a lot of the tensions that, you know, I think all of the, knowing what I know about all the panelists here, all of us have to some extent, whether it's in sociology or photography, you know, these issues of being able to explain ourselves and things like that are so well and directly addressed by this text that Julie's produced. So we're going to kind of reverse order here and go back through our group and do a more, yeah, the panel Q&A. I wanted to hit a couple points, though, first. One is that a lot of these elements of experimentation of that we've been talking about and that Greg so nicely alluded to, I think, are fairly intrinsic to feminist theory and feminist methods. And so then that can bring us back to just this question about hydrofeminism specifically, that Julie, I'd like you to maybe define, talk about, or at least explain a little bit how you think about that term. Then also, this is maybe either for Julie and or Greg, if you could you define ethnography or how you think about ethnography for us as just a baseline, and then we can go to the hydrofeminism issue.
Ethnography is a qualitative method developed in anthropology, used in more social sciences, including sociology, political science as well. And it is based on, most of the time, although not always, what we call participant observation and immersion, where the researcher stays in a community or a group for a more or less extended period of time. And we usually like mix different methodologies, including interviews and observation as part of ethnography. So the bottom line is that it's really based on being immersed within the community. So about like experimentation and hydrofeminism, you're right that, I mean, experimentation depends what you mean by experimentation, because if you're experimenting, it means that you, I mean, it's always compared to a set of more or less legitimized theories or practices, and like what, where is the boundary between what is experimental and what is more easily legitimate within a specific field. At a certain time, also depends a lot on countries. For instance, using photography in sociology is more experimental in some countries than compared to others, because the field hasn't been institutionalized through university departments and course programs and publications and so on. So anyway, but the use of creative methods beyond scholarly writing is definitely very commonly used in feminist and decolonial practice, based on the understanding that scholarly writing has been developed as like a medium through which legitimate science as developed in Western Europe, according to the model of universities that we know today, has been invisibilizing all the forms of knowing or other forms of making sense of the social reality around us. And this can include drawing, painting, sounds, performance, theater, puppetry, I mean, any kind of artistic or expression that is not scholarly writing. And these kind of methods are indeed very much used in this field, because it's a way to build counter-narratives of what has been marginalized or subjugated throughout the evolution of social science disciplines as well. And it's, I mean, hydrofeminism, as we mentioned, is really based on this idea that there is a very intimate connection between water as an element or a resource or something part of the natural environment and embodiment and body experiences. And based on this connection, there is indeed the willingness to raise awareness in terms of water crisis or environmental crisis or environmental damage in general, because water is part of the human body and such an important part in feminist embodiment. Because there is this connection, it doesn't make sense to exploit or to like develop this set of practice as developed in Western industrialized societies, based on the exploitation of allegedly limitless resources, which are not limitless, obviously, and like developing extractive practices that have long-term ecological damage. It's what Rob Nixon called slow violence. Most environmental violence is slow violence that is like implemented through long-term processes, which makes it very difficult to to visualize or visibilize or and analyze within a specific time frame, because it's not sudden, it's not spectacular, it's in the long term, and most of the consequences of extractive practices are not visible right away, like biodiversity extinction, for instance. It takes a while. But hydrofeminism is absolutely not the only theoretical framework that develops this kind of idea. It's because I mean it's the reason why I tried this connection with the colonial ecologies or the colonial theory in general, indigenous theory in the book, because it's something that is like the foundation of these theories as well. What I call holistic ecologies or holistic cosmologies in the book, because they are based on this understanding of a whole where human beings are connected to any forms of life in the environment, like from the ground to the cosmos. And because there is this understanding of ecologies as a coherent set of living entities that includes human beings, it also encourages a different approach to environmental resource and the environment in general. So it's not specific to hydrofeminism, because it's something we can find, I mean, in all feminist ecologies, what we call ecofeminism as well, and indigenous theories. It's an idea that was developed in the earliest works in ecofeminism, like to have this connection between the exploitation of marginalized bodies, including female bodies, and the exploitation of natural resources as part of the same set of representations, like cultural representations about the environment, which generates specific social norms and set of beliefs, which translate into practices that are embedded by human beings depending on where they live. It's what we call socialization in sociology. But yeah.
For those listening and who might not have the book, Julie was hitting on a number of different components of the text there. Of course, there's the writing that we've been talking a lot about that has a mixture of personal narrative, personal reflections, but also different theoretical engagements with these different frameworks that span several different intellectual fields. I'll ask a question, and then we can kind of reverse order and go back through our panel, starting with Greg and then to Jess and Micah. Julie, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the drawings, because they're a little bit abstract. There's a few of them that set off each chapter, and I wanted you to just speak briefly about how those came about and maybe how they connect the different parts of the text.
Right. So I like to make drawings. This is just something I do often, not as part of my practice necessarily, but I've, for instance, made a lot of drawings for the past few years for tattoos. I have, like Greg, a few tattoos, and I like to make drawings for them because I'm only having, at least for now, all my tattoos are illustrations I made myself. And drawings and illustration is something that is very commonly used by a lot of feminist scholars I admire a lot, including Gloria and Zaldúa, who I refer in the acknowledgement at the beginning of the book, because she has been a huge influence for me for this book in terms of how she used different techniques and forms of expression to build her own narrative. And so yeah, it was an interesting way to connect, to have another different level of expression in the book between the photograph and the writing parts of the book. So there is a drawing for each chapter that kind of makes a transition. And I was not, I mean, I didn't have a specific rationale for this illustration. I was just hoping that they could contribute to the overall emotional experience of reading the book, like, and maybe have a, what's that? Which is the best reaction I could get, I think, like generating questions and reflections. Even if some can be obvious, like this one, like the one you put on the slide, I don't know how clear it is that it's a constellation, so connected to stars as a way to make a connection with the chapter it opens to.
In the first versions that Julie and I were working on, the drawings weren't there, and then I think you showed me one over an email, and I was like, wow, I don't know exactly what this is or what it means, but we should find a way to include it, and hopefully, we did so in a nice, interesting way that, as you said, kind of, this one that's seen here on the slide is a constellation. There are others that engage in different forms of abstract representation that I think you can read in particular ways in relation to the text. So, Greg, go ahead. I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah. So for me, at the center of that, the ethnographic enterprise, doing that kind of research, is this ongoing dialectic between, which you've talked about, immersion and abstraction. And there is this, we can call it a tension, we can call it a dialectic or a relationship, but the point is, like, we have to be immersed in these situations. It's part of the craft of doing it, and also reflecting on the kind of concepts and theories that we're working within, with an ultimate goal to reduce it all in what could be considered an act of slow violence to a text output, right? To an item on a curriculum vitae, a thing that advances our career, for which we're known, a thing for which we have book talks and panel discussions and so on and so forth. And these are all measurable. And so I just wonder, like, what are you, like, practice, and you referred to this earlier as the tension, and like, what are, and how you thought about it, but I'm wondering, what are some of the practical, specific, concrete ways that you try to think to deal with this tension, which is unresolvable?
It is unresolvable. I would probably spend the rest of my life or career working on that tension. But what I like is that this tension generates questions and troubles and emotional mess. And it forces me to reconsider my practice and think about my own positionality in the field. And it's a good thing, I guess. I think, I know, it's a good thing. We need to be self-reflective. It's also part of ethnography. So being as worried as I am about these kind of questions, I think it's the foundation of my scholarly practice, and I try to cultivate the discomfort it generates. One way to, I mean, this book was for me a way to approach this kind of questions, because I didn't want to write a traditional academic book. Like, I had already published a first monograph, so I didn't have this pressure coming with a coherent, conventional monography kind of book. And I had the luxury to be able to ask myself the question, what do I want to do with this book, without commitment or pressure or expectations, or like, this is a time where I can actually think about what I want to do with the book. And it can be as weird as I want. It could be even weirder, obviously, because it had to remain within the format of a book, right? So, which is a limitation somehow. And it had to be also more or less not understandable, but it needed to be not so obscure that it could not resonate with anyone else, which was also a limitation to my expression of weirdness, I guess. Because, yeah. And it was a way to reflect on these kind of questions also, because at the time, I was not affiliated to a university. I didn't have like this institutional framework to influence my practice. And I started to develop this book a few weeks after finishing the commercial diving training part of my ethnography, which I did without an institutional support or without funding. And it was for me a way to like reclaim this fieldwork practice outside of all of those conventional university frameworks. Like, this is something I do by myself. And at the time, I wasn't even sure I would actually use it for my research. I just started diving and I loved it and I followed the flow of that. And a few months later, I ended up with this bunch of certifications, which allowed me to enter the commercial diving program. And I developed an ethnographer's interest in commercial diving along the way. So everything was kind of mixed up at the same time.
Well, and I think that it's so interesting to me what you're saying now, because we hadn't really talked about it in this way before, in terms of what you're discussing is the fact that ethnography as a form of social science, we don't think about very often, if ever, as being practiced outside of the academy or without some kind of institutional affiliation like that. Contrastingly, I think that's different in the history of photography. People build photographic careers and engage in photography in different ways, often having successful fine art careers without any kind of institutional affiliation, or at least maybe sporadic or precarious types of affiliations. So yeah, that was something also that just made the book so rich, and as Greg said before, really inspiring for building one's own practice. Jess, I'll pass it to you here in terms of some questions or further comments.
I think I asked my main question a little too early on accident when I was curious about hydrofeminism. And then I also had a question about the drawings. Sort of different than your question, though, is that they're quite representational and they feel like a really big contrast, because they're so representational as compared to the photographs that kind of like become less and less representational as we go on. And I was just curious how you thought about that contrast between these like very, very representational drawings and these really sort of increasingly abstract photographs.
It's interesting that you mentioned that contrast. I didn't really think about it. It was not my intent to have that kind of contrast, but I was definitely interested in having different forms of narratives that were like distinct enough of each others to not necessarily overlap and be somehow work as a dialogue. So it's interesting to have this rupture between indeed the representational or evocative like power of either the drawings or the photographs. And it's very much related to how I thought about the photographic narrative of this book. Because what I wanted to try to develop was, as I mentioned, more like a sensorialscape. My first idea was to build on the sensations that the body experiences when immersed in water, including disorientation, for instance, when you're diving, like you could have your feet in the direction of the surface and your head on the seafloor, for instance. It doesn't make a difference technically for the body as it is with the buoyancy in the water. and the weightlessness of water. The difference it makes is like depending on the kind of regulator you use to breathe. Some are not designed to be upside down, so you might have some water in the nose or this kind of stuff can happen. But there is this disorientation and the fact that the way the body functions and all the consequences it has on the mind and how we understand the world around us is how all this is destabilized in water, because it just doesn't make sense in the water. Like to have up and down and right and left, you could completely disrupt that if you let, I mean, regardless of like the limitations of the life support system used in water. But when doing free diving, for instance, there's nothing that prevents you to like move your body in the weirdest unconventional way you can imagine, because this is just something you can do in water and you cannot do with a weightness on the ground. And I was interested in so exploring that and also the similarities between outer space and underwater environments. Because my previous research was focusing on outer space and the training of astronauts, which is very similar to commercial diver training. And for some of the photographs in the book, including the one on the slide here, what I wanted to try to create was a confusion between those two very different but yet similar environments. Like, I wanted images where you actually ask yourself the question, where is it? And to have like, because the shape of the water, so it's the water surface from underwater, and the way the light reflects through the surface, and we are not just quite sure, maybe, whether it's somewhere in outer space or somewhere in the water. Mm-hmm. Hence also the black and white, because it just added to the confusion and the messiness of these images. While I used blue for most of the drawings also, which is a way it builds more contrast as well. Yes.
Well, in the outer space nature of that was another thing that drew me to the images themselves. The more that Julie and I talked, was this this question of outer space, this in the way that the images were, the images that you had in initial selection. You know, for example, this image that we've got here was one that I loved initially, immediately, as soon as we were paging through, you know, the different pictures for the project. We've got, you know, this single arm is so interesting and intriguing and odd, that's kind of jutting out of the bottom right hand part of the frame. And then you have the you're disoriented by the way the horizon is oriented there, kind of also at an angle. And then the way that the light is playing, you know, that you, unless you knew that it was that was an underwater image, you might not know exactly what you're looking at first. Yeah.
From an image making perspective, I was interested in, for one, how, like, the last question about like where kind of you draw the line of how much to include about yourself, and then with the image making, how do the images that you're making, I think you kind of talked a little bit about it with the disorienting quality of some of them and that kind of thing, but how does that just bolster the like personal narrative? I'd just like to hear you kind of talk generally about those ideas.
That's a great question, and I might not have an answer to that question, but
sure.
What I know is that as I experienced it with this book, there is something much more intimate and vulnerable in abstraction, because somehow those images are They are more intimate because they are the result of my own imagination or my emotional response to some situations. And it's an interesting dynamic. I also try to explore in my work like this articulation of intimacy and documentation. Considering that the way we define what is documentative and not is also a tricky question. what were your previous points? I was lost in my thoughts.
Oh, sure. Just kind of how you decide how much to include yourself and then how much to kind of focus on that compared to more of the like theories and ideas you're kind of working with.
Yeah, well, again, there are a lot of different theoretical methodological frameworks in social sciences that emphasize the importance of the researcher's subjectivity and subjective experience of everything that happens during a research process and the importance of not silencing some situations or experiences or emotional responses because they have such a strong impact on the resulting knowledge that we choose to circulate or not. And this is something I've been reflecting on for the past 10 years or at least at the earliest stages of my research process, because I've always been interested in ethnography because it's such an emotionally messy method, such a rich methodology, and it's impossible to clearly draw a line between what is personal and what is research in ethnography. And this is what I like about this method more than anything else. But it's also the reason why I've always focused on this kind of question, like what to include in a scholarly article, for instance, what to include in the PhD dissertation. And for my PhD dissertation, I actually wrote a whole chapter about this, about what I wanted to, about the curation of my data and how much I self-censored when I wrote my PhD dissertation. It was a chapter that received a very mixed reaction among the members of my committee, because we are not always supposed or expected to open this kind of question. I guess it's very uncomfortable, and I was also, by doing that, questioning the very way we transmit ethnographic knowledge as part of course or research supervision, like the set of unsaid informal things that are transmitted through the pedagogical relationships that shaped a student or young researcher, researcher's approach to fieldwork, to ethnography, to what we are allowed to say or what we are not allowed to say, regardless of the consequences it can have. And a few years ago, for instance, I published an article about the experiences and the silencing of experiencing sexual assault during ethnographic fieldwork, because there is very little literature. There is absolutely no literature about this in French. And it has such an impact on how the ethnographer approaches the field and makes selection in what is said or what should remain unsaid, because it's like embedded in very uncomfortable and overwhelming emotions. But those emotions are part of the field, and those emotions are are the reason why we choose to do certain interviews with certain people, or why we don't do interviews with some people because we don't want to meet them, or and just silencing this doesn't make sense, because then the knowledge we circulate is completely biased and very far away from what is actually experienced and produced and understood. And so, yeah, there's a set of ethical and political considerations in the way we create data in the field. And this was also part of my reflections for this book. Although I wanted to remain very elusive in this book,
sure.
I didn't want to be focused on my life experience as much. It was more focused on experiencing weather, which was
I think it comes across well, where you're not giving us any real concrete details about yourself, but then at the same time there's a very strong narrative voice that, like, there's no mistaking that this is not you. This is very much it's you, and you never get the feeling that it's a generic kind of voice. It's always very strong.
Along with that, something I had been thinking about as you were describing more of the details of the work itself, and then in relation to what Micah was saying, there it seems, well, how is so we've kind of touched on a few different theoretical concepts that are in the book. How do you think about theory in terms of what is the assistance that it gives you, or how do you think about that? How is it, in what ways are you in conversation with theory? How is it helping you? Not only, because it seems like it's not only methodologically or in terms of writing articles or whatever, but there's a more personal dimension to even that as well.
I'm definitely going to get a t-shirt that says theory is important to me.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's a very personal thing, personal way. It's the way I approach sociology in general. I've always been very passionate about it. I started by studying anthropology and then moved to sociology because of, the person that was able to supervise my master's degree research was in sociology. So it was really in terms of disciplinary structure of university departments where I was a student. But I always got this visceral and like body and style engagement with sociological theory or social scientific theory or theory in general, I guess. I was also reading a lot of philosophy of science and ethics and political theory because it's how my brain works as well. I'm just really into that always. And yeah, I was also a student for a while at Sciences Po, which is a very competitive institution. And if you're a student there and you don't read like a lot more than other students, you don't get a chance. So it was luckily for me, it was easy because I was already doing that anyway. But it was definitely something encouraged for my studies while I was there. I mean, we had to be very intellectually curious in order to develop like critical thinking and an original standpoint or perspective, critically informed again about everything. But yeah, I've always been into reading some theories.
I think theory can be personally helpful, clarifying, through reflection and reflexivity and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was what I was about to say. Although I tend to use theory as a therapy, I guess, it most of the time it helps make sense of things that would otherwise remain unarticulated. So obviously that helps a lot to make sense of the chaos that is the world in general. And I mean, readings like feminist theory, for instance, is also very common in groups of activists. It's just something people in these kind of groups do because it informs their practice as well. I mean, it's hard to get mobilized about something if you don't know what this something is or what are the politics of like how systems of oppression work and intersect in our contemporary societies based on gender, race, class, and so on. So reading about these things is also the foundation for collective action. So I guess it's something, I mean, theory is important in many different frames of life or areas or groups where I evolved since I was a student. And I guess activism was also a big influence to me at that point because it got me to read also some kind of works and authors that I would have never met as a student in a university department in sociology.
All right, everybody, this has been Immaterial Voices, a production of Immaterial Books. The theme music you're hearing for this episode is produced by Wyoming Toad. And thank you to all the panelists, especially Julie Petrin-Jusek, for the discussion. Looking forward to seeing you in the next episode.